fact that you all have an exam this evening. And if I was a really nice guy, I'd tell you one of the exam problems. But I'm not, so. In any case, I don't remember, because I of course wrote two exams, and I don't remember which problems are in which exams. I think the exam might be a little bit harder than the last one. Well, this one might be a little bit harder. So so don't panic if you find it hard. Here's my inside tip, your tip for coming to class today. It might be a little bit harder, so don't panic if it seems a little bit harder, okay? The rest of the people will be panicking. You know, you can sit there calmly. Everybody will be...
Yes.
Okay. So, I'd like to continue the discussion that we were having about special relativity and all of the strange things. Remember, all we did was to assume one thing which was entirely reasonable... One postulate, which says that basically life is independent of the reference frame. Yeah, life. I mean, our life, experimental life, life is independent of the reference frame in which we live it. Everybody agree with that? You know? Okay, so, and the second postulate is that... C equals C. We'll condense them down. The speed of light is the same for everywhere. Okay, and I had started off this discussion by doing an example of a clock, right? So the clock consisted of... this is not a bouncing ball. The clock consisted of a meter stick and a laser beam, which would fire off some light. And one tick of the clock was how long it took the light to come to the top, bounce off of a mirror, and go down. And from that, we had come to the startling conclusion that time is not time. Time is a much more elusive thing than you might have thought. Because if you have somebody that's moving, I don't know why I drew a spaceship like that, but never mind. If you have somebody that's moving at some velocity u, and they've got a clock which is reading time t prime in their hand, and if we define a constant that's called gamma, which is 1 minus u squared divided by c squared, the square root of that, that the time that somebody else who was sitting on the ground would observe would be equal to, things inside the in the rocket ship slow down. So an interval of time on Earth that takes time t would take a time t divided by gamma in the spaceship. Okay? Which is leads to this rather implausible conclusion, like of the twin paradox, for instance, that if you have two twins and you send one twin, Stella, to the nearest star and back, when she comes back, she's a lot younger than the twin that stayed behind, assuming that she was moving at some speed that was close to the speed of light. And that's a thought experiment. Obviously, we can't do that. But I had also told you that this... Yes? She is actually younger. Less wrinkles. Truly younger. Her biological clock is just younger. What is it? Telomeres is why you guys say that people are aging now. So her telomeres are, do they get long or do they get short? Okay, they'd still be longer. Okay? And as a real world example of this, or as real world as physicists get, we discussed muons. If you remember, muons are born at the top of our atmosphere, approximately 10 kilometers up. And when a muon is born through a collision of a cosmic ray with an oxygen molecule or something like that. When the muon is born, it heads down towards Earth with a speed which is just less than the speed of light. Say it heads the speed of something like 0.99 times c, and eventually comes down to the ground. And I had shown you that every physics undergraduate does an experiment in which you measure the lifetime of these particles. And that lifetime turns out to be 2.2 microseconds. Yet, in 2.2 microseconds, a muon could only travel about 600 meters. So there's no way, there's no way they could get down to the Earth in any significant number. Of course, lifetimes are a statistical thing. Just because the half-life of something is 2.2 microseconds doesn't mean that some of them won't last for 4 microseconds or 6 microseconds or something like that, but an ever-decreasing number of them last. And it would turn out that nothing would last. And there's a lot of these particles, because I mentioned to you that something like 1,000 of them per second are going through your body as you sit out there. Okay? So the only way this could be true, the reason why they actually have time to do this, is that our clock, which says that, well, at the speed of light, what would it take? Two microseconds? Ten. It would take about 30, something on the order of 30 microseconds for them to get down to the ground. Okay? That's what we would observe. I mean, we shoot a particle at the speed of light here. It'll show up on the ground 30 microseconds later. Okay, so that's the amount of time we think took place. But because of this time dilation factor, as it's called, this equation over here, it actually only took about 2 or 3 microseconds in the muon's time. And so that's perfectly okay. They can survive that trip. And I think that's where I left you more or less, right? Are there any questions about that before we go on? Okay, well, if not, let's go on to the next problem with this analysis. As you probably know from sitting in BART trains or in other trains, if there are two BART trains stopped at a station and the other BART train starts to move, you will get the feeling that you're moving too, right? Actually, you don't get the feeling that you're moving. You get the feeling that you think you're moving, you don't think the other one is moving at all, typically, right? And this is because we only know about our surroundings by looking outside of us. We could feel accelerations to be true. But the point is that the way we've been considering this problem is a very Earth-centered way. We've been considering that the muon is born up here and it travels 10 kilometers. That's what we see. But if we were living on the muon, if we were an ant on the muon, what the ant would see is the Earth rushing up to meet it, right? We basically normally assume we're not moving, other things are moving. So we would see the Earth rushing up to meet us. And at what speed would we see the Earth rushing up to meet us? Well, it turns out that one of the things that's preserved in all of these relativistic things is velocities. So if we think the muon is going down with a speed of 0.99 times the speed of light, the muon thinks the Earth is coming up at a speed of 0.99 times the speed of light. Okay? And now we have a problem, because the Earth started at 10 kilometers away, and in 0.2 microseconds, which is how long the muon thinks that it's going to live, in 0.2 microseconds, the Earth is only going to move about 600 meters. Right? It's the same calculation. And so from the muon's point of view, the Earth would get to here. And yet the muon knows when it hits the Earth. Everybody agrees. When a real event like the muon slaps into the Earth, nobody's going to dispute that that's what actually happened. So the muon knows that it slapped into the Earth, and it slapped into the Earth in 2 microseconds. Okay? So it slaps into the Earth in 2 microseconds, and yet it started 10 kilometers away. How could that possibly be? It can't. It just doesn't work, because the Earth only moves 600 meters or so, according to the muon. And so the resolution to this puzzle must be that as far as the muon is concerned, the Earth started out 600 meters away. So we have the second real puzzle or conundrum about special relativity, that lengths don't stay the same. In other words, if I measure if I measure this ruler, it's 1 meter long. Everybody agrees with that. But if I, you know, if I was a javelin thrower and I could throw this meter stick at a speed that was close to the speed of light, then we would not think that, we would not see this meter as being 1 meter long. The meter stick would shrink. And we actually know exactly how much it's going to shrink by. An object which is moving, so here's an object. Okay, it's got some, let me draw it like this. It's got a length, some length, and it's moving at some velocity mu. So the length that we would observe, which I'll call L, I'll call this length L prime. We'll come to how I'm defining this. So L prime is the length of somebody that's sitting on the meter stick would measure. Okay, so there's a little ant sitting right here, and that ant would measure that it's 1 meter long. What we would measure in the laboratory is that meter stick is L prime and then divided by gamma, the same gamma that I had defined over here, which shows up in time dilation. And that will make everything work. How does it work for the muon problem? Well, we don't have a meter stick, obviously, here, but there's some length. It's a 10-kilometer stick, if you will, okay? From the ground up to the top of the atmosphere, or where this process happens in the atmosphere. And that 10-kilometer stick is being thrown upwards, effectively, from the muon's point of view. That 10-kilometer-long stick is moving upwards like that. And since it's moving upwards at a speed that's close to the speed of light, then the length of that thing is going to shrink by this factor. And that will be 600 meters or so, so everything will be okay. Yes? Yes, well, let's talk about true lengths for a moment, because it's a good question. Physicists don't use the word true, but we do use the word proper length. So the proper length of something is the length that's observed by somebody which is stationary with regard to that something. So if here's an object and I'm sitting on top of the object, I will measure its proper length, okay? And if I'm moving along like this, I will still measure the proper length. It's all of you who will measure the incorrect length, or the length which is shrunk by this amount. So if you will, if you insist, we can define a true length, which physicists would call the proper length, and that stays at 1 meter long. But for all practical purposes, the meter stick has genuinely shrunk down. Okay, it has gotten shorter, and there's no way around it. This is the amazing thing about special relativity. We just started with two very, very simple ideas, right? I mean, these seem innocuous, almost. Well, they seem innocuous to me, anyway. And yet, they lead to all sorts of these very, very strange ideas. Yes? Well, space can distort itself in general relativity. So if you want to take this to the next upper level, perhaps you go there. But you don't need that. It is a good description that it genuinely shrinks, okay? And I'll give you some examples of how we know that it genuinely shrinks in a few minutes, or an example of another thought experiment. Other questions? Well, we have both operating all the time. Both time dilation and length contraction operate all the time on moving objects. And it turns out you can't reconcile, you can't have one without the other, because you can't get them to reconcile with each other. You've got to have both of them if life is going to be consistent. Well, so you need to be very, very careful with these primes and not primes. This is part of the trouble with special relativity, is you just get confused about what object you're talking about, okay? Generally speaking, today in this class, I'm going to try and use a primed coordinate for the coordinates of the moving object. All right, so I said that this is genuinely 1 meter long, and it's moving along, so it's 1 meter, L prime is 1 meter, and it will shrink. Okay? And time, a little clock on this thing, would be going along, and it would slow down, if you will. There's also a definition, by the way, of proper time. A proper time is the time that you observe on a clock which is moving in your reference frame. So if I'm in the rocket ship looking at a clock, what I see is what I would call the proper time. Well, what you would see would not be a proper time on the rocket ship. You would have your own proper time if you looked at your own clock in your own hand. That would be your own proper time, if you will. But okay, more questions? Yeah. I'm sorry? Yeah, more or less. I mean, 2.2, 3 microseconds. Some of them do annihilate along the way, which is why more people get cancer in Boulder than they do down in Denver, I should say, is the example people usually use, than they would here in Berkeley. Because Denver is higher up, and so there are a few more of these muons, and the muons aren't generally bad for you, but every now and then they cause cancer. So I think the cancer rates in Denver are about 1% higher than they are here, simply because it's higher up. And more of these things are there. So some of them definitely annihilate on their way down. So, like, I shouldn't say annihilate. They decay.
So to that thing, they add close to the speed of light, it seems like. But even for us, the path.
Well, okay, so let's be careful. The experiment I described where we measured its life to be 2.2 microseconds is an experiment in which we brought the muon to a stop. If the muon has come to a stop, we would measure 2.2 microseconds. But obviously, if the muon is moving from the upper atmosphere, that takes 30 microseconds to come down. So if it's moving, we would not measure its lifetime to be 30 microseconds. I'm sorry, 2.2 microseconds. We would measure 30 microseconds or something like that. Okay? It's only when it comes to a stop that we can properly make this measurement, because we need to make the measurement in the rest frame of the muon itself, which, since we can't climb aboard the thing going at 2.2, you know, near the speed of light, we've got to bring the thing to a stop to make the measurement. Okay? 2.2 microseconds, by the way, is a pretty long time in the world of particle physics. I mean, people think of things that lasting a short period of time that last a picosecond or less. So picosecond is 10 to minus 12 seconds. So this is forever. Yes? Okay. Actually, if we were doing special relativity in a more mathematically complete manner, if I was actually going through the math, we would spend a lot of time talking about synchronizing clocks. It's a fascinating topic and a difficult thing to do properly. So we can certainly set two clocks to be synchronized, okay? But that doesn't mean that they'll run at the same rate. That's the Stella and Terra problem. Stella sets her clock to be Terra's clock, before she blasts off, she comes back, it's a different speed. But this gets really complicated, really conceptually complicated very quickly because of all of these considerations. I mean, for instance, if your question was, would we see the clock tick at a normal rate. That was not your question. Well, because I'm a physicist and I know how to mathematically transform between these clocks, yes. But I can't give Stella and Tara wristwatches which will beat at the same time. They simply won't. Okay? I can transform between what... At every moment, Tara can calculate what time it is on Stella's watch. That's not a problem. But it'll be a different time than his time. Other questions? Yes. Well, the second one, yeah, okay, the first one is innocuous. The second one, I mean, the second one is more comp, is more less obvious, okay? But let's put it this way. I mean, people knew that the speed of light was the speed of light for 40 or 50 years. They had Maxwell's theory before they realized what all of the implications of it were. It seemed simple enough. Turned out to have all of these strange consequences. And I have not finished with the strange consequences, by the way. There are more to come. So maybe I should move on to them. So remember my original method of measuring clocks? I said, what was our original clock? Our original clock was we had a ruler and we shot a laser beam upwards until it bounced off a mirror and then it came back down. And then I moved it along. Remember, I moved it along and then you saw there were these triangles and I showed the path lengths were different, and that's how we determined that the clocks were different, right? So some of you must be thinking, well, what about length contraction? Right? If lengths contract, why wasn't that proof wrong? Why didn't the person on the ground, you know, here's the meter stick, it's moving along like this. Why didn't that shrink down to some short length, which would obviously change the answer? Okay, you see the dilemma that we have? The answer to that dilemma, which will sound perhaps just like I'm making things up, but the answer to that dilemma is that only lengths parallel to the motion shrink. Lengths perpendicular to the motion do not shrink. Okay? And you need that to be consistent. How do I know that? Well, here's one way I know that. If you could hold this ruler like this, okay? If I throw this ruler at the speed of light, it's going to collide at the top and at the bottom here, right? And we would know that. If it had, this ruler had some chalk as it went by, it would make chalk marks at the top and the bottom. It's not plausible that if this thing shrunk, then you would think it would make chalk marks here and here. And that's not plausible. Okay? That would violate stuff. I mean, one of the reasons why it would violate stuff is, here, could you stand up? From your perspective, you run towards me. If I saw your thing shrink, then I would say that on my ruler, it would make chalk marks down here, right? So we would get into a huge fight. If this thing shrinks, you would say that I made chalk marks right here and there. And I would say, no, you made the chalk marks that were right here and here. And we can't have that. We have to agree on what happened. So the only way that we can, thank you, the only way we can resolve that paradox is to say that these distances don't shrink, because then we don't have an inconsistency. Okay? So transverse distances don't shrink, which means that, for instance, that if I run down this classroom like this at the speed near to the speed of light, I get skinnier. Okay? Because my height doesn't change, but all of that disappears. I could become a model. Well, I haven't seen too many models with gray beards, but never mind that. So, okay. So is everybody, I won't say happy or content with all of this, but I'm going to move on to my next problem, okay? Which is this. I just went through this explanation with chalk and all that to show you that transverse lengths don't shrink. But let's consider two rulers which have the same proper length, and there are two cowboys riding the rulers. And one of these rulers is moving in this direction, so this guy thinks this one shrinks. But from the perspective of this ruler, that was the one that shrunk. Now, I can't set up a chalk experiment to prove that that didn't happen. Think about it, right? I can't do the chalk game. So that's okay so far. I haven't violated anything. But here's where I'm going to violate your intuition. Let's say I have a barn. This is a classic way of putting this problem. I have a barn, okay? Here's my barn. And let's say this barn is 10 meters wide. And I have a ruler which is 12 meters long, but it's moving very fast. Say it's moving with a speed such that gamma is equal to 2. Well, that meter will shrink. Okay? That meter will shrink so that it's only, instead of 12 meters, it's 6 meters long. And if the meter stick shrinks, that means that there will come a moment where let's say I had a door on one side of the barn open, and I have a door on the other side of the entrance side of the barn is, I'm sorry, the door on the far side of the barn is closed. The door on the entrance side of the barn is open. The meter stick has shrunk down to 6 meters. So there comes a point in time where I can close both doors of my 10-meter-long barn while capturing a 12-meter-long meter stick inside my 10-meter-long barn. Okay? That's just a consequence of what we've been saying. If lengths shrink, then I can do this. Everybody agree? Yeah. Well, there are issues with picking something off the ground that are moving near the speed of light, and I don't mean to be facetious about that. Okay? I can't. You're asking me, if I measure it, if I take a photograph of it, it will appear to be 6 meters long. There's no question about that. But its proper length is 12 meters. No, it's real. I can close both of the barn doors at the same time. Yes. Okay, excellent question. Let's think about this from the point of view of the person on the meter stick. So what does the person on the meter stick think about the barn? Yeah, it's smaller. It's just smaller. So the barn, actually, we know how big the barn is. How big is the barn going to be? It's going to be 5 meters wide, right? Because I used a factor of 2 here. So the barn is going to be rather skinny now. I'm going to make everything smaller because I'm going to draw a series of cartoons. So here's the situation. This is 12 meters. It hits this door. It starts to enter the door. Now, the barn door can be closed. Maybe the barn door on the far side was closed from the beginning of time, right? And the entrance side door was open, even in this case initially, right? So that's the situation. And then a little bit later on in time, as far as the meter stick is concerned, the meter stick hasn't moved, but the barn has. And so a little bit later on, we'll have... we'll have this situation. Right? The barn has moved. The meter stick is about to hit that door. Everybody agree? Now, we have to agree on consequences. Somebody would notice if the meter stick hit the barn door. It would splinter. So either it hits the barn door or it doesn't hit the barn door. You can't have it both ways. If the farmer says that it didn't hit the barn door, then it didn't hit the barn door. So what must happen? What has to happen? If it's not going to hit the barn door, then the barn door must open. I should have said that obviously in this case, a little bit later on, this barn door is going to have to open, right? The meter stick is moving along. I should have mentioned that. The meter stick is moving along. And a little bit later on in time, the meter stick exits out of the other side. And it's gone like that. Okay? So it never... In other words, the farmer can only briefly close the door simultaneously. Okay? I'm sorry, I really should have mentioned that before I began this story from the perspective of the meter stick. But what must be true from the perspective of the meter stick is... Sorry, I keep on moving the barn. Moving the meter stick, but it's the barn that's moving from that perspective. From the perspective of the meter stick, the barn moves... to here, and both barn doors have to be open. Otherwise, it would splinter a door. And then a little bit later on, the barn is over here. And this door closes, and I suppose if you want to keep on doing this a little bit after that, the barn has just completely cleared. And that has to be the way it went. Everybody agree? Because otherwise, the meter stick hits the barn door. So from the farmer's perspective, and I really blew it, because from the farmer's perspective, he started out with both of the doors, I'm sorry, that door closed, that door opened. That allows the meter stick to enter the barn. Then he can briefly slam both of this door closed, so the barn meter stick is totally trapped inside the barn. And then he has to open this door to let the meter stick progress out the back side of the barn. That's got to be the sequence of things. But there was a moment where both of the barn doors were closed. And that's possible because the meter stick is shorter than the barn. But from the perspective of the meter stick, there never was a time where both of the barn doors were closed. And so this brings out yet another paradox. About special relativity. Which is that it violates the principle of simultaneity. So what do I mean by that? Let's say I have a fort. Okay, and it has two cannons. for simplicity, the cannons point straight upwards. And there's a captain over here, and there are two people that fire cannons behind each cannon. And the captain says, fire, and both of these cannons fire simultaneously. That surely can happen. The captain can say, these two things fired simultaneously. Okay? Now, let's consider that from the prospect of a spaceship which happens to be blasting by. Perhaps the spaceship, perhaps they're trying to hit the spaceship as a ship as it goes by. It turns out that from the perspective of the spaceship, the two cannon do not fire simultaneously. From the perspective of the spaceship, the spaceship thinks that this cannon fired first. And I'm not doing the math for this. It's just algebra, but it gets puzzling. I'm just trying to present the concepts here. And that's how we get out of this problem. That we have this confusion that we think when events are simultaneous, like what's the simultaneous event here? It's both barn doors being closed. We have a confusion that we think that actually means they are simultaneous. But it depends on your perspective. What is simultaneous to the farmer is not simultaneous to the meter stick. So there is a time, perhaps, well, in this particular situation, there is no time when they're simultaneously closed, the way I set this up. Okay? There just isn't. And that should bother you. I hope it bothers you a little. If it doesn't bother you, you're not thinking about this, or you're really, really smart. Because the reason why we believe in simultaneity, probably all of you haven't really considered before what does it mean for things to be simultaneous. Have you? Not in any deep way. But what I think we all intuitively think about a lot, or have an intuitive concept of, is a more sophisticated concept called causality. If I shoot you, you shouldn't die before I shoot you. Effects have causes. And when we think about simultaneity, we're really thinking more about causality. That if I push, you should move after I push, not before I push. Okay? And simultaneity seems to require that, right? I push, you move, that's because they're simultaneous events. But simultaneity is a little bit more subtle. It is true that, if I push, your head will move simultaneously. Okay? But, and everybody will agree to that. But if I throw a ball which hits your head, and your head jerks back when the ball hits it, everybody will agree that your head jerked back. But everybody also better agree that your head didn't jerk back before I threw the ball. Right? Causes have to follow effects. I mean, before physicists started thinking about this, nobody even questioned that that could possibly be an issue. But it is an issue. One does have to think about it. And theories which violate causality are very, very suspect. Remember this big stink that I talked briefly about particles going faster than the speed of light? One of the reasons why nobody believes that particles can go faster than the speed of light is it turns out that that would allow you to violate causality. If information can go faster than the speed of light, then effects can happen before their causes. But things don't go faster than the speed of light. And it turns out, though I'm not going to go into the details of why here, it turns out that even though simultaneity is broken, simultaneity is not causality. There's nothing... I mean, you may find this really weird. You should find this really weird. But the door didn't splinter in either case. There's no consequence of this, right? Everybody's happy. The guy on the ruler is happy. The farmer is happy. Nobody thinks that something happened without a cause. And none of what I've been telling you so far allows causality to be violated. It only violates simultaneity. There's no observer, for instance, if I shoot a bullet at you, there is no observer who thinks you die before I shoot that bullet. Every observer may have a different opinion about how much before you died I shot that bullet. Some people might say a long time, some people much, much less. But nobody will conclude that you died first. And there's nothing here. There's nothing here that says that. So are there questions about this? I'm just asserting that. I haven't proved that, obviously, to you. Nor have I proved the statement that if things could go faster than the speed of light, they would violate causality. But they would. It would be possible to do that. Yes? Do you mean, when is this going to be on the test? Well, we can't build macroscopic things that go faster than the speed of light or even close to the speed of light, but we can certainly build microscopic things that go faster. It's easy for us to make particle accelerators that move particles at near the speed of light. And that's one of the ways that all of this plays out. But this also plays out in astrophysical solutions. It plays out near the Big Bang, where things were moving very fast. Sure, there won't be barn door problems. Unfortunately, there probably won't even be rocket ship problems. But there are natural phenomena in astrophysics and on small microscopic scales where all of this matters. And so it's not an empty exercise to conclude things. And there are questions which are perhaps an empty exercise. For instance, it turns out that if this clock is like that, I forget the details of how this works. I've worked this through in the past. But if this clock is tilted like that, and I run very fast towards the clock, it turns out that I'll see the back of the clock, not the front of the clock. Let's not even go there, okay? That's true, but I can't think of any practical situation where that matters. But these issues of simultaneity being broken, those do have very practical consequences in accelerators and at the near the when the Big Bang was formed. You know, another practical consequence for you is you probably all have GPSs by now. Half of you have them in your phones. If people didn't understand all of these issues, and I mean all of them, including issues that we haven't even discussed that come out of something called general relativity, if people didn't understand those in details, GPS would not work. It really, really matters if you're trying to tell that, you know, before people really thought these things through and more to the point had the computational power to think these through, there were positioning systems. And since World War II, there were things called Loran systems that people could tell approximately where they were. But those were accurate to miles. And I have a GPS on my bike, which weighs like 5 ounces, which is accurate. They won't claim it so, but in reality, it's typically accurate to about 10 feet. And that's, you really have to know all of this stuff and get it right to get that all to work. Because while the effects are very small, the distances involved, the satellites are a long way away, right? And so if there's even the smallest error in what they're doing, that's going to translate to a huge distance. And the satellites are moving reasonably quickly, actually. I mean, by our everyday standards. But not at speeds that we would normally consider relativistic. Nonetheless, it matters. And that's probably, by the way, how these people in Italy screwed up with their speeds faster than the speed of light, is that they just didn't get these effects quite right when they were trying to figure out how far away things were in times and things like that. Other questions about this? And the answer to will this be on the test is probably not. I mean, it's hard for me to translate any of this to a test problem. So those of you who are only in this class for the A, this was a waste. But I think if you're interested in how the world works and how we understand the world, or at least physicists understand the world, these issues are very important. So good luck on the test this evening. And I'll see you guys all on Friday, where we'll conclude this.